You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, gone are the warm, sunny days of Shandy's, Saisons, and wheat beers. We'll get a preview of some heftier brews that can help with the cold this winter season. Now, Wisconsin is getting closer to Election Day, but not the 2020 presidential race we've been hearing so much about. There's an election for a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Three candidates will face off in a nonpartisan primary in February next year, and the top two vote-getters will advance to the general election in April. All three candidates met for their first debate yesterday in Madison. WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White was there. Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
This race a little under the radar with a presidential race going on. Can you introduce us to the candidates?
So one of the candidates is the incumbent, Justice Daniel Kelly, who was appointed by former Governor Scott Walker in 2016. So he's been on the bench for a little while, has a little bit of a record, of course, in terms of, you know, how he's ruled on things. He's considered to be the conservative-backed candidate in the race. And then he has two liberal-backed challengers, Dane County Judge Jill Karofsky and Marquette University Law School Professor Ed Falone, who actually ran for state Supreme Court unsuccessfully in 2013.
And with every state Supreme Court race, there's some boilerplate that I could just record and play every time. These are officially nonpartisan races. There isn't an R or a D next to the candidate's name, but everybody kind of knows who's the Republican-backed candidate and the Democratic-backed candidate, though the candidates themselves deny it, right?
Exactly. So the role of kind of partisan politics has been getting more and more prevalent in state Supreme Court races. They are officially nonpartisan, but partisan spending has really increased in these races. The last state Supreme Court election that Justice Brian Hagedorn won over Judge Lisa Neubauer actually set a new state record in terms of spending for a state Supreme Court race. So though these races technically, you know, as you mentioned, these candidates don't have a D or an R next to their name. It's pretty obvious in terms of kind of what camp is behind them and hoping that they end up on the bench.
Before we give a brief listen to the candidates, what was the tone of this debate like yesterday, Laurel?
Well, it was pretty tough, honestly. I think starting out kind of out of the gate, the two liberal-backed candidates were going after Justice Kelly and not really mincing words. I think it kind of set the tone for how this debate and how this race is going to play out over the next several months.
Let's give a listen to Dane County Judge Jill Karofsky, as you say, attacking the incumbent Daniel Kelly.
Find in favor of those special interests over and over and over again. And that feels like corruption to people in the state of Wisconsin.
And then I want to give a listen to the incumbent state Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly kind of responding to this line of attack.
I don't judge the result of a case according to a political lens. I judge it according to what the law requires.
All right. So what did we get out of the back and forth between Kelly and Karofsky and Ed Falone? We'll listen to in a bit, but making similar attacks.
Mm-hmm. So really Karofsky was saying, you know, Kelly's partisan, background, including his work. He was on the litigation advisory board for a group that we talk about an awful lot in state politics these days, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. That's a conservative advocacy group that's filed a number of state-level lawsuits about state laws. They just sued the State Elections Commission over how they maintain voter rolls. So Kelly has a connection to some of these organizations, that organization in particular. And so Karofsky has said, you know, you've ruled in favor of groups like this. And she said, you know, it's hard to believe that the rule of law, that the law is always on these groups' sides. So she definitely didn't mince words there, saying that some voters might see that as corruption. And Kelly really came back and echoed a phrase that we've heard from a lot of Supreme Court candidates over the past several years, which is, hey, I keep my partisan ideas, my own political beliefs very separate from my work on the bench. He actually declined to answer a question about when he's decided a case against his own personal beliefs, because he said, I just feel like we shouldn't be engaging in a conversation about that at all. These two concepts should be completely divorced from each other.
Talking to WPR's Laurel White about yesterday's candidate debate for the three candidates seeking a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the incumbent state Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly, Dane County Judge Jill Karofsky, and Marquette University Law Professor Ed Filone. I want to give a listen to Ed Filone. We haven't heard his voice yet, talking about his view of judicial theory.
I've looked at every possible judicial theory of interpretation. I can tell you, I reject them all. I don't believe in any big picture idea.
Was there a lot of talk about judicial philosophy among the candidates?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting part of the debate. That was, I think, the first question actually out of the gate, which was asking each candidate to kind of identify their judicial philosophy, especially through the lens of U.S. Supreme Court justices and sort of whose philosophy adheres most closely to their own. Filone obviously didn't really answer that question. Daniel Kelly didn't really answer it either. Jill Karofsky was more comfortable with the question. She was pretty quick to say Ruth Bader Ginsburg is somebody she really admires. She likes her philosophy and actually even made a joke. I think it was the only kind of lighthearted moment of the debate. She said she's on the list to donate an organ to Ruth Bader Ginsburg if she needs one.
Stepping back from the debate, what's the current makeup of the court in terms of people viewed as the conservative-backed or liberal-backed justices?
So the makeup of the court right now is 5-2. It's a 5-2 conservative majority. So the result of this race, wouldn't, even if a liberal candidate unseats Justice Kelly, wouldn't change the partisan balance of the court. But it would set up the potential of the partisan balance switching in the next state Supreme Court race. So some liberal groups are kind of trying to play the long game with this race. I think that subsequent election is in 2023 when the current Chief Justice Patience Rogensack is up. So certainly the partisan balance of the court is something that's on a lot of folks' minds.
These elections can be pretty tight, right? In the last one, wasn't there a margin of something like 6,000 votes out of the whole state?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we're looking at these days for statewide elections in Wisconsin. We obviously had a very, very close race between Governor Evers and former Governor Walker. This race was very tight, the last state Supreme Court race between Justice Hagedorn and Judge Neubauer. That was about 6,000 votes out of 1.2 million cast. So generally, state Supreme Court races see a lower turnout than some of the big races that we have, you know, a presidential race, for example. But that might be a little bit different this time around because the April election between the top two vote getters that get out of the primary in February is actually on the same day as the Democratic presidential preference primary. So we could see quite a few voters, particularly Democratic voters, turning out for this election next year.
And as you mentioned, Laurel, the last state Supreme Court race was a record setter in terms of money spent. Are we seeing the money machines being fired up just yet on this one?
I'm not aware of any big spending yet in this race. I think it's something that folks are definitely keeping an eye out for. I don't think anyone that's a political watcher in Wisconsin is expecting it to be very different this time around, that's going to be ratcheted back or anything. It's been a really kind of steady growth in terms of, you know, spending and conversations about partisanship and party affiliation in these races. So I think we're looking for more of the same.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, WPR's state capitol reporter. She was with us today to talk about what happened during the first debate for candidates running for a seat on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. The primary for that race is February of next year, and the general election is in April. Coming up, what was the best wildlife sighting you had in 2019? We want to hear your story. We'll be taking your calls. You can get in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Whether it was here in Wisconsin or in your travels around the world, what mammal, bird, reptile, fish, you name it, have you seen that was really cool and memorable? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll take your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a few minutes, we want to hear from you about your favorite or most memorable wildlife sighting, either here in Wisconsin, maybe even out your front door, or on your travels, wherever they may have taken you. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll take your calls in a few. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story just in time for the start of gun deer season this weekend.
Wisconsin's deer hunting season is underway, with bow hunting lasting until January. Hunters plan for this time all year long, imagining the challenge of the hunt and the thrill of bagging their prey. Ron Weber dreamed of hunting for the perfect buck since he was a young boy. Decades later, that day finally came. Ron shares with us what happened.
I was 7 years old the first time I saw my buck. He was a 10-pointer with a wide sweeping rack and long tines stained dark brown from spruce pitch. The buck hung in my grandparents' guest room above the bed I slept in during our visits. Each night before the lights were shut off, I'd stare up at him, the gleam in his eyes hinting that his spirit was still alive. In the morning, as daylight slowly lit the room, I'd be waiting as he materialized out of the darkness. Even then, I was a hunter and dreamed of the day I'd be able to join Grandpa for the annual pilgrimage to deer camp. A month before deer season, when I was 13, Grandpa spent the day at the hospital visiting Grandma, who was sick. He returned home, went to sleep, and never woke up. I wish I could have hunted at least one season with him, but that wasn't where the trail led. Grandma moved a couple years later, and my buck went to an out-of-state relative. From then on, the buck lived only in my memory. By my early 20s, I'd learned that getting my buck probably was not going to come easy. It's funny how 1 year can turn into five, and soon decades. Though I crossed paths with many nice bucks, none fit the mold of the buck that once hung on Grandpa's wall. That would change on November 8th, 2015, 4 decades from when I'd first laid eyes on him. It had been a windy day with temperatures in the 50s. Though the rut was in full swing, it hardly seemed like November when only light clothes were needed. I didn't climb into my stand until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd only have a couple hours to hunt, but with high deer numbers, I was confident. At 4:15, I caught a glimpse of a deer moving through an opening in some balsam firs. I thought I saw horns, but the deer melted into the balsams before I could be sure. From the shadows, I could see a deer start to materialize out of the darkness, like those mornings at my grandparents'. Suddenly, there he stood. He was magnificent, the buck I'd waited for my whole life. The sweeping rack, long dark tines, a perfect 10-pointer. And he was going to walk right past me. At 10 yards, through a veil of pine branches, I watched him rub his antlers on a hawthorn tree. Two does moving along the edge of the cornfield caught his attention. He followed the does, and the cornfield swallowed him up. After waiting 40 years, he was gone in less than 5 minutes. I never moved, never even considered drawing my bow. 5 years earlier, I had harvested a small buck and pledged to myself the only deer I had left to shoot was this buck that lived in the shadows of my memory. Now I realize that I had no more deer left to shoot. That's a tough thing for someone who has been a hunter since they were 7 to admit. 2 weeks later, on the second day of the gun deer season, my buck of a lifetime became the same for one of my neighbors. I was happy for him. A part of me wished the buck could have stayed swallowed by the cornfield forever. Still, each of us has a vivid memory of when our life's path crossed with that majestic animal. My neighbor's hangs on the wall of his den, a beautiful mount, I'm told. My buck of a lifetime hangs where it always has, in my mind's eye. It looks just fine there.
Ron Weber is a Wisconsin DNR forester living in Weyerhaeuser. He writes outdoor essays for several Wisconsin publications. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, a couple weeks back on Central Time, we talked to conservation biologist Sumner Madison about his memorable sighting of black-necked stilt, it's a kind of bird I learned, at Horicon Marsh.
I was more than delighted and absolutely, quite frankly, I was absolutely astounded because I had never seen a black-necked stilt in Wisconsin before, much less stilt with chicks. And because they lay four eggs, you know, here they had good hatching success, all four hatched out. We later found out that the production, the number of young produced, was also very good. So it was really a remarkable event for both myself and Daryl Christensen.
Now we're asking you, what is your favorite wildlife sighting memory this year or in the past, Wisconsin or beyond? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Cameron starts us off in Delavan. Cameron, hi.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. What's your story?
So this past summer, I was going on a long bike ride, like 70 miles.
Wow.
And I went through the Kettle Moraine near Whitewater. And I was going along, and I saw this big, great bird in the middle of the road. I think it was a red-tailed hawk, but I mean, I was going pretty fast. And it spread its wings and, like, flew right at me. You know, I wasn't sure what was going to happen. I didn't think I was going to, you know, get hurt or anything. But, I mean, I saw its talons, and they were, like, 2 inches long. And I just remember being, like, really impressed. I thought it was pretty inspiring.
They're pretty impressive close up. Now, I was at a red light around the corner from my house, and a red tail landed on my windshield wiper, stared at me, and then flew off just before the light turned green. Seeing those guys up close is pretty impressive, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Cameron, thanks so much for starting us off with your wildlife sighting story. We'll go now to Devin in Waukesha. Devin, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Devin?
When I was in Arizona during the summer to visit my great grandma, I saw a coyote, which is pretty cool.
Cool. Had you ever seen one before?
No, I haven't.
Okay. And I got to ask, you're in Waukesha. You've been seeing the story about the turkey that's following the postal delivery person around your town?
No, I'm from Beloit. I'm just up here.
Oh, you're in Waukesha
work.
Now. Okay. All right. Devin, thank you so much for sharing your coyote sighting. We're taking your calls about wildlife sightings in Wisconsin and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us next in Woodruff. Brian, hi.
Yeah, okay. So this was in August, actually a couple years ago now. And I was out late at night on a totally, like, new moon night looking at the Perseid meteor shower at the time. And just totally watching meteors come by fairly frequently, completely into it, oblivious to everything else, when I heard a vibrating humming noise coming from behind me. It completely freaked me out, I have to admit. And I froze without any idea what I should be doing, whether I should be running or ducking or diving into the lake or what. And it sounded like a that comes across. And all of a sudden, over the top of my head, a great blue heron just comes flying right over me, swooping around in circles, lands in front of me in like 10, 15 feet in front of me, and just sat there.
Wow. How long did it hang out in front of you?
It hung out until I moved because I was totally frozen, and I don't think it even noticed me.
Wow.
And then all of a sudden, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 minutes later, I kind of flinched a little bit, and it took off.
Now, that noise, I mean, did you think maybe space alien for a second there with that weird vibrating noise? Be honest.
I got to admit, it crossed my mind.
Brian, thank you so much. That's fantastic. A great heron sighting. We'll go now to Rana with us in Rice Lake. Rana, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So this was last winter, and it was about 2 a.m, and I was in a dead sleep, and I heard some rumbling kind of noise outside, and I thought, oh, it must be the bear and the bird feeders again. What is going on? He should be hibernating. So I flipped the light on, and I saw a donkey and a pig standing by the bird feeder, and I thought, I must still be asleep. So I flipped the light back off. I was convinced it was the bear. I waited a minute, flipped it back on, and the donkey and the pig were still there, had escaped from the neighbor's farm. But I sure thought it was a big old bear, because we have a lot of them in our area.
I thought maybe you'd wandered into a children's book, Rana. Donkey and pig are friends or something.
Yeah, good idea.
All right, Rana, we'll look forward. We'll interview you when you write that book. Let us know if you need an illustrator. We are taking your calls with your wildlife sightings, or in this case, domestic animal sightings in your yard. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Stephanie joins us in Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. A couple years ago, I was in Orlando, and we took a trip 2 hours north, and I can't remember the name of the little town, but we were chartering a swim with the manatee set up. And so my son and sister-in-law and nephews, and we went in search of manatee and get snorkeling. And we came across a baby. Well, it's pretty big for a baby, but a baby manatee. And just my son and I were near each other, but about 5 feet away underwater with our faces in the water. And just from nowhere, the mama manatee just zooms right underneath my son's legs. And he and I look at each other and we have that real, you know, surreal look. And then I was a little nervous because of like, oh, my baby.
Yeah, because these guys are big, these manatees.
They're big. They're basically, as I'm sure you've heard it says, you know, cows in the water, and they spend 90% of their time eating algae.
All right.
That's what they do.
Stephanie, thank you so much. We can get another caller or two in. Sadie is with us in Madison. Sadie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually relate to that manatee story. I just moved back to Wisconsin from Florida and had a similar experience with manatees there. But I'm originally from Wisconsin, and I majored in wildlife, actually, from Stevens Point. And what was cool is I did a spring, you know, technician jobs, and I was really into birds, so I did warbler research. And a couple of these guys I was working with, we were doing point count surveys for warblers in Black River Falls area, staying at Sandhill Wildlife Refuge. And we'd seen wolves around like maybe once or twice, like way up on the road, crossing the road, and like just a blink and they were gone, and was like, wow. But one morning we pulled up to where we were to spread out and do this point count, and it was this gravel road in Black River Falls, and we're looking up this road from our van. You know, we had just gotten up, and I just couldn't believe it. There were two big wolves way up the road. We were going, holy cow, and we got the binoculars out, and within like 2 minutes, these four wolf pups.
Well, and wolf pups, we're going to have to leave it there. Sadie, thanks for all your calls. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Here comes the news. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to pollster Charles Franklin. He shares the latest numbers on what Wisconsin thinks about the president, impeachment, state politics, and more. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, there are a lot of signs we look to when the seasons roll from one to the next. One of the things that changes with the mercury dropping, for those of us who can or choose to partake, are the styles of beer. Especially with the explosion of craft beer, it seems like there are more and more specific brews for each season. Jessica Jones is co-owner and brewer for Giant Jones Brewing Company in Madison. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Robin Shepherd is a regional beer writer and contributor to Isthmus, the Madison Weekly. He's an associate professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences. Robin, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you, Jessica, as a brewer yourself, look forward to coming up with kind of seasonal brews?
Sure. I mean, we rotate everything except for our double IPA through the seasons, which provides variety in what we're producing, what choices I'm making in the brew house, what we're ordering. And it just gives me something to look forward to, something different.
I guess flipping that around, do you feel like you have any choice but to come up with different seasonals? It seems like the beer fans really expect this nowadays.
Oh, sure. I mean, people really want something new all the time, but people also still want what they know and remember. So it's balancing those two things of both the what's new and what do we love. So,
Robin, we've talked about the craft brew explosion a lot of times over the years. Do you see more and more attention paid to seasonal brews?
Oh, but yes. There's a certain group of beer hunters out there that crave that seasonal approach. There was a survey last year by the Craft Brewers Association that said, you know, the number one style that we all love are hoppy beers. But the number two in that is seasonals. And that kind of is what Jessica was talking about. The seasonal gives us an opportunity to do that beer hunting, that searching, that, you know, that matching it up a little bit with the weather outside, the sky conditions. It gives you a little bit of a chance to shake things up through the year.
Jessica, as a brewer, and I'm guessing a beer fan yourself, if you've gone into the business, what to you personally says winter in a beer?
It's pushing towards toasty notes. I play with roast all year round because it plays just like cold brew in the summer or is comforting in the winter. But when I'm playing with particularly toasty or biscuity things, so it's really English beers. The strong English beers is what I look for at this point.
What's at the top of your list as it gets cold, Robin?
Well, I'm looking at the leaves. I'm thinking I want something with a little bit more color in it. I want something just with a little bit more sweetness to it. Maybe a little bit more alcohol, too. Fall is a great time to begin to ease into the even bigger beers that we think of in winter, where they're more winter warmer kinds of things. So I'm looking at the colors. I'm looking at a little bit more body and a little bit more sweetness.
Well, we had some tastings here. Some of my colleagues at WPR got together. Want to give a listen to one of the first ones now, a Scotch Ale. Our tasting example here is the Nuglaris Snowshoe.
What's going to get you through the winter? All right, it is our beer tasting at an undisclosed location. Our theme this time is winter beers, strong beers. Tim, you're saying beers that can, you know, boost our winter soul. That was the theme.
That's what I'm going for.
Winter solstice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. What do we got? You can introduce the beers here.
Okay,
Tim.
So we're going to start with Nuglaris's Snowshoe.
Yeah, let's pour those up.
We'll pour a little bit for everybody.
We've got pretzels. Should we eat all the pretzels before anybody tastes beer? Okay, now everybody's tasting the Nuglaris Snowshoe Ale.
I'm getting a lot of malt up front.
Mm-hmm. It's bitter, but then it dissipates quickly.
I think it has a nice caramely finish. It starts off a little more bitter, but then it sweetens as it goes on.
What's the excitement level here? I don't feel a lot of buzz in the room right
Not
now.
Not a lot of buzz, no.
I think it's a good solid beer. I mean, I'm struggling.
It's a drinking beer?
Yeah.
Right, like you could hand this to somebody after they said they wanted a beer, and I think most people would be able to drink it.
They would identify this as a beer.
Mm-hmm.
Check.
Yeah.
Scotch ale. Talk to us a little bit about what a Scotch ale is, Jessica.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's Scottish ales and there's Scotch ales. Scotch ales are very strong ones, and Scottish ales are the 3-7% Scottish-style beers, driven mostly by malt. Toasty, maybe just hinting at some darker roast things, but bitterness is very low. They're just gentle, easy things to give you a hug.
Robin, do you have any favorites in this category, either Scotch or Scottish?
Well, I'm a fan of the beer that you just tasted, actually. That's one of Nuglaris' oldest beers. It's been around since the mid-1990s. I think it probably airs more into the amber Irish ale category than the Scotch ale. It's exactly what they talked about. It's a beer that's it's been around a while. It's like an old friend. It's not going to be something that's going to, you know, push your taste buds at all. It's just there, and it's just a nice, non-offensive beer that usually has redeeming qualities for about any drinker.
Yeah.
We're talking about great beers for the winter season. Jessica Jones is with us from Giant Jones Brewing Company and Robin Shepherd from Isthmus Weekly Newspaper in Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite winter seasonal beer? What is it? Do you have a question for our guest experts about what makes a good winter seasonal beer? Do you need a recommendation maybe for the Thanksgiving table? I don't know. 800-642-1234 is the number. Again, 800-642-1234. Want to move on now to the Belgian ales and give a listen to our gang here with another tasting. We're getting to Belgian ales.
Everyone clear have a pretzel.
Yeah.
Pretzels.
So the next one we're doing is Three Sheeps. This is out of Sheboygan, and their beer is called Veneration. It's a Belgian-style quad with figs, molasses, aged in rye whiskey barrels. So like, a lot happening here. We'll go ahead and pour a little bit out.
Thank you. The color, this one's pretty.
You can smell the figs.
While you're tasting, this is Three Sheeps Brewing Veneration ale, Belgian ale.
Wow. I think this is like a two-sipper. You take two sips and then grab a different beer.
Wow. Uh-oh. With 13.2% alcohol by volume, I'll point out.
Well, you can taste it.
Uh-huh. Right. So for Bill, this is a fighting beer. Any other more positive responses?
If you like rye whiskey, which I do, this is good. It tastes a lot like whiskey, and the figs even give it a little bit of a sort of a winey aroma. So I like it quite a bit.
I feel like this would knock you down if you had more than
one and a half, and you'd probably get very sleepy. But it's tasty. I like the rye flavor, too. I like that it was in rye whiskey barrels. You can taste it.
Very sweet, though, too. Like, I definitely think about this as, like, a Christmas time, like, really rich, sweet, aromatic.
Leave out for Santa.
Leave out for Santa. That's right. Here.
Need more pretzels.
Yeah, and I'll warn people, a running theme will be Bill Martin's, I think, having strong opinions about some of these beers as we go. So 13.2, I think I said alcohol by volume. Yep. That's high, right, in our beer world.
That's even higher than anything I make at Giant Jones, and I just make big beers.
How typical is this to see something with that high in alcohol volume content?
Well, that beer fits into the Belgian quadruple category, mm-hmm. and those beers, I mean, characteristically are going to be 8% above, and so it's not uncommon to find one in the 10% range. That particular beer began about 3 years ago, and it was a bomber-only beer, and Bomber would be a 22-ounce bottle.
Okay.
And so they moved it over into the smaller 12-ounce bottles because there was a big following for that beer. I think the description about that's a great table beer or a dessert beer for Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Those rich, sweet qualities, right, Jessica,
with
the plum and the raisins and the figs.
Yeah,
I mean,
put that next to pecan pie.
Oh, my land.
Belgian quad, what does the quad part of that mean?
There's a style system that was really just developed by a marketing department, but
okay.
It's doubles, triples, and then quads were introduced only just a decade or so ago. But they're a stronger version of a double.
Okay.
And usually most of that's coming from carameled sugars rather than malts.
And in the case of this beer, it gets 5 months of aging in rye whiskey barrels. So not only do you have that wonderful sweetness and alcohol from the fermentable sugars, then you get a little bit of that residual boozy spiritness that really warms things up.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ryan is with us in Eau Claire. Ryan, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Ryan?
Is anybody going to pick up the slack for Shock Top canceling the pretzel wheat? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Shock Top pretzel wheat? Either of you familiar with that one?
Shock Top is a Budweiser brand. They're all based on wit beers. I haven't had that exact beer, but if you're looking for that sort of thing, a wit beer, WIT, it's a Belgian-style wheat beer, would be the thing to look for, particularly from your local brewer.
And I usually, Robin, hear people talk about that kind of beer more in the summer. Is that right?
Well, that would be where I would put it. But, you know, seasons are kind of what you define as
yeah.
a beer drinker, right? Jessica will tell you that one of her best-selling beers, the Porter, is sold in the summer, but you might look at it thinking it's dark. It might be something I'd put in the fall, but a porter is a great beer any time of the year.
Yeah. I mean, how much cold brew coffee do you drink in July? You know, drink a porter. Same thing.
I ice my coffee all year round. We're talking to brewer Jessica Jones from Giant Jones Brewing and beer writer Robin Shepherd, who contributes to Isthmus, the Madison Weekly paper. We're talking about winter beers, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you reach for when the temperatures go down in the winter? What's a good snowy season beer? Maybe a good beer for holidays? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a question about these kind of beers, our guests probably have some form of answer for you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about winter beers with brewer Jessica Jones from Giant Jones in Madison and writer Robin Shepherd, contributor for the weekly paper Isthmus. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite beer for the winter season? Maybe a cozy evening at home, maybe with a holiday meal for friends and family, or do you have a question about winter seasonal beers? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller. George is with us from Falls Church, Virginia. George, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, George?
I just really wanted to express my appreciation for you guys talking about these winter-style beers. Winter warmers, Doppelbock, barley wines. These are some of my favorite styles of beer, and frankly, I think it's a shame that we only get to have them in the winter. So I guess my question would be, what would it take to see more of these styles on the shelves year-round?
Oh, interesting, George. Thanks for the call. Jessica, what do you think?
That's what my brewery does. We make these big styles all year round. We have a few that are a bit lighter that we do in the summertime, but you'll always find something like barley wine or something in the amber field at our brewery. And we always have a big stout or a big porter. So it's happening just as ways to differentiate breweries from one another.
Is this something you see happen often, Robin?
Well, yes. I mean, I think there's certainly a niche area, and maybe it's more than just a niche for larger, big formatted beers like that. But I mean, we also need to kind of point out that one of the hottest selling drinks right now are the seltzers, which goes the other way completely. You know, they're the lighter, next to water kind of things, and there's a huge market for those that are in a growing sense of the market share.
Let's go back to our tasting crew. We've got the stout and porter category. What makes them good for winter? And this will be one that hits close to home for at least one of our guests, I think.
All right, ready to move on to another.
So the next one, number three. This is Giant Jones out of Madison. It's their grand stout. We're going to have her talk about this beer. I don't know a ton about it other than it's fairly new in their lineup, and people are pretty excited about it.
Okay, let's pour it out.
Whoa, that
very dark.
Is
that looks like,
thick.
That looks like chocolate syrup.
It really does.
Very dark.
I don't want chocolate syrup. Giant Jones Grand Stout is what we're trying.
Right? So a lot of, like, roast.
I was going to say, it tastes really smoky. Mm-hmm.
It smells that way, too. It's almost a coffee smell that comes off of it.
Better than I thought it was going to be. When it came out of the bottle and I saw how dark it was, I was a little bit like, well, am I going to like this? But I think I could probably ride one bottle out.
Okay. What's your social setting? What's
horizons are expanding.
What's our social setting for this beer?
The Snowshoe might be more of a front porch beer. This is kind of a living room by the fire beer.
Yeah, I agree with that. I thought it would be like a little bit more viscous.
I like that it has a heavy flavor, but not a thick, syrupy consistency. Mm-hmm. It goes down pretty easy, although it does have a big flavor.
Pretzel up.
That sounds great.
Do you want to expand on that one, Jessica?
Sure. I'm just relieved anytime people don't despise my beer, right? I mean, especially with one of the tasters in the room as a critic.
You did not get to hear that previously. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so that I make really dry beers. I mean, Robin mentioned sweetness earlier. One of the things I look for is for beers to not have a lot of sweetness because it lets you taste the other flavor active things that are happening. So that when they said, oh, there's a lot of flavor happening, but it's not that, you know, heavy viscous thing, and part of what they're noticing is just a lack of sugar because the yeast have consumed it.
Mm-hmm. All right. I mean, I think that's a good point. I mean, beers can be sticky, sweet, cloying. That's not necessarily a good thing in beers, whether it's a winter beer or a fall beer. I really like Jessica's beer from a standpoint of it's got a little bit of that coffee in it. It goes really well with desserts, I think. It's just phenomenal towards the end of the meal.
Mm-hmm.
Let's bring on another caller now. Kurt is with us in Appleton. Kurt, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What do you got for us, Kurt?
I got a recommendation. I like out of Founders Brewery, they have a breakfast stout that I don't know all the adjectives that go with it, but it's like chocolate, oatmeal, 100 other different things. And I found that if you let it set for a little bit and head gets a little warmer, then you get all the you can taste all the different adjectives as it warms up a little bit.
Kurt, thanks so much for that. Warming up or letting the stout warm up, I assume not on a stovetop, but that's going to let us taste more?
Oh, yeah. I mean, temperature suppresses your perception of flavor, partly because things are just staying in solution, but you're also numbing your tongue. So most beer is going to be best 45, 50 degrees, just like red wine.
Huh. Do we typically drink beer at the right temperature, Robin?
Well, if you're from England, no, absolutely not. We Americans love their beer super carbonated and really cold. And we've just been sort of conditioned by advertising to do that. I think the idea of warming a beer, particularly one that sort of has a malt focus to it, you know, you just let that thing warm up very slowly, and you'll be surprised at the different layers, and it'll change as it continues to get a little warmer. It's a wonderful way to experience a stout or a porter or a barley wine. It's just to just let it sit there, swirl it maybe a little bit. Don't shake it, but just kind of swirl it gently. Let the aromas really, you know, come out of it as well.
Talking about winter beer with Jessica Jones from Giant Jones Brewing Company and Robin Shepherd, beer writer for the Isthmus newspaper in Madison. Let's go back to our tasting crew. You just said the magic word barley wine. That was our next tasting.
Our fourth beer is by Potosi, from Potosi. They're calling it the Grand Amber. It's a brandy barrel aged barley wine. So again, we've got a liquor barrel that they've aged it in. And so this one is going to be probably a bit more viscous.
Thank you.
I'm not loving how this smells, got to be honest.
I'll smell nice it. Golden red color.
Yeah, it is really
amber.
Pretty.
Oh my gosh.
So one.
Okay, give me that dump cup.
Oh wow. Okay.
Put that one in there.
Just straight in.
Not a barley wine guy, I guess.
Bill's face right now is great.
Wow. I wasn't ready for that.
I'm going to out myself a little bit. I don't typically like barley wines. I think that this is okay for a barley wine. It does have like a very boozy flavor that I don't always want in something that's supposed to be beer-like.
I think this has more heat than any of the others. Like my, just my mouth is like warm from like the alcohol and the hops. I mean, it's pretty hoppy.
What is the ABV, alcohol by volume?
Yeah, you know me. it's very small print. Is that 11.5? I think it's 11.5.
I love it.
I like the color. But that's about where it's going to stop.
I enjoy that you can tell this was aged in a wood barrel. It tastes woody along with the wine flavor. Definitely sweet, one to have in moderation, but as someone who doesn't normally like barley wines, I think it's pretty good.
I think this would make a great gift. I would definitely give this to the beer snobs in my life. Like, you know, it seems like a special occasion beer that you would gift it.
All right, barley wine. Is it technically, I forget who let Bill in the room. Is barley wine even beer technically?
Yes.
It is.
Absolutely. Yep, 100%.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. It has, so it's an old British style where the term came from. They were beers that were strong, so they rivaled wine in strength, and also historically they were aged in large wooden vats out in the brewery yard, and so 18th century, that's taking on some microbial things, plus the oxidation of those malts, you're getting these fruity flavors coming through. So,
yeah, this particular beer, I believe, is aged in brandy barrels.
Yep.
So that gives it an additional sweetness. Jesse, you were kind of feeling funny about your beer and talking about it. This beer, I'm kind of feeling a little bit of remorse because I picked this as my beer of the year about 2 years ago.
Okay,
so
everybody but
agree
Bill
with
liked
it.
Everybody Bill liked it.
Right.
So I want to – we also taste this cider. I think we're not going to have time to listen to the crew. I want to give a listen to their verdict. The cider was a Brix cider from Mount Horeb. I think generally pretty favorable response on that. Let's listen to the overall verdict here.
Do we have a best in show? Anybody want to pick their favorite?
I like the snowshoe, the first one we did. That was good.
Slash is the only one you didn't not like. Am I right?
Yeah.
I'm with Bill on the snowshoe, but mostly because I like ambers and reds and malty things. So that was right up my alley.
I think the snowshoe, or kind of a surprise for me, the Potosi barley wine was really good, too.
I'm going to go hard in the paint on the cider. I think it's very, very nice and kind of more what I'm in the mood for, even though I really like darker beers on the whole.
I really like Three Sheeps. It was just sort of like is unapologetic about it's doing all the things. But I think it's doing them well.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
And then do you guys want to leave us with a recommendation for another great winter beer before we're out of time? Jessica, you want to go first?
The Sizer from Brix Cider is just amazing. Be a great thing at any point during your Thanksgiving table.
Fantastic. And Robin?
I'd have to go with just look around for a barley wine. I mean, I'm into that mode already. So they're a little harder to find, but Jessica's got one out there, and there are a handful of other breweries that do them.
Well, we're out of time. That flew on by. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We're talking to Jessica Jones, co-owner and brewer for Giant Jones Brewing Company in Madison, and Robin Shepherd, regional beer writer and contributor to Isthmus Newspaper in Madison. You can keep sharing your favorite winter beers. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, more Americans say they're not affiliated with a particular religion. What does the future hold? An expert on belief in America joins the show with an outlook on religion in the year 2030. Amazon is working toward one-day shipping for more and more products, but a guest says the convenience comes with a cost for workers and the environment. And begun this streaming war has, Disney kicked off a new streaming service this month. They've got Star Wars. We'll get the latest on the spread of TV and movie streaming. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6:30, we count on first responders and other emergency workers in times of crisis, but are they getting enough sleep to do their jobs? We'll hear from the Eau Claire Police Department about how they try to keep officers well-rested. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a Wisconsin comic book author is making a big splash with the first issue of his comic book called The Hawk, and he's 17 years old. We'll find out where he finds his inspiration and what advice he has for anyone who might be hesitating about following their own creative dreams. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.